Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Tim Shorrock, a Washington-based investigative reporter and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence, and discuss his article at The Nation, A Modern-Day Stasi State, and the role of ex-NSA and CIA head General Hayden and others who accelerated the privatization of intelligence to the point where today over two-thirds of the intelligence budget goes to private contractors. Then we'll examine why the good news about the improving economy has not been covered in the press, in contrast to the earlier flood of the sky is falling reports parroting propaganda from deficit hawks like Wall Street billionaire Pete Peterson. Mark Blyth, a professor of international economy at Brown University and author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, joins us to discuss how America escaped the austerity trap that has mired the Eurozone, even though the deficit hawks are still demanding we follow Europe's disastrous path. Then finally, we will look into a new report from a year-long investigation by CNN, the Tampa Bay Times, and the Center for Investigative Journalism into the 50 worst charities in the United States who took in $1 billion last year and only spent $50 million on the needy. Kendall Taggart, a researcher and writer for the Center for Investigative Reporting, joins us to discuss the report on America's worst charities, which is available at cironline.org, and the scandalous fleecing of generous Americans who think they are donating to help dying children. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tim Shorrock, who is a Washington-based investigative journalist and the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. Over the past 35 years, his work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, Daily Beast, Mother Jones, The Progressive, Foreign Policy and Focus, and The Asia Times. His latest article at The Nation is A Modern-Day Stasi State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Shorrock.
Thank you.
And Tim, you've been really ahead of the pack in terms of focusing on the intelligence industrial complex that only recently came to light with the Edward Snowden affair. And much of the argument, of course, in the press is the familiar argument of civil liberties versus national security. But I've lately been talking to former CIA officer Bob Baer, who's saying that everybody that comes out of the agency and out of the special forces complains to him about the contractors swindling the public. And I spoke with William Binney the other day as well, and Thomas Drake. And so, I mean, obviously, you probably agree with me that this is where the real story is, isn't it? Some of this stuff doesn't work, and billions are going in this form of right-wing welfare.
Absolutely. That's one big part of it. But I think in terms of what's happened in terms of Snowden's revelations is that we really need to look at the fact that a company like Booz Allen Hamilton is involved like this at the highest levels of U.S. intelligence. I mean, that's also the big story, that they're doing operations that many Americans consider unconstitutional and dangerous, yet they're at the highest levels there at NSA and CIA and lots of other agencies. And I think that's very dangerous. And yes, in terms of swindling the public, that's a great term. And, you know, Bill Binney and Tom Drake were the whistleblowers on one of the NSA's worst intelligence failures, which was this foolish idea, I might add, to privatize their analysis of signals intelligence. According to Drake, they wasted upwards of $6 billion on that project, which was managed by the contractor SAIC, when Booz Allen Hamilton was a subcontractor as well. And they never produced an iota of intelligence, and the thing was shut down and canceled in 2005. It was a disaster. And there's disasters like this have been repeated again and again within intelligence, and the problem is they're classified, they're secret, we don't find out. Very hard to find out what actually happened and the kind of swindling that really does go on.
But the people who are in charge get promoted for wasting the taxpayers' money. In this case, General Hayden was in charge of the NSA when Trailblazer was blowing through $6 or even $8 billion. We still don't really know the full figures. Look at Booz Allen, the ultimate revolving door with the former head of NSA, and now its vice president, the former head of national intelligence, a former employer. And they, Booz Allen, are in turn owned by the ultimate revolving door company, which is the Carlyle Group, started by Frank Carlucci, former national security advisor to President Reagan. So this is the part that I find really disgusting, is the immunity here that these people have from wasting the taxpayers' money because of this cloak of secrecy.
That's right. No accountability. And you know, I call it not a revolving door, but a spinning door, because these people go in and out. I mean, McConnell at Booz Allen started out, you know, in the Navy intelligence. He eventually was promoted to be the director of the NSA under President Clinton. Actually, in the latter days of the first Bush administration, he served as NSA director during the Clinton administration. Then he went back to Booz Allen Hamilton running its military intelligence programs. And then he went to be the director of national intelligence under President Bush. And now he's back at Booz. And you see this again and again. And I think one of the real questions is, what kind of understandings, not necessarily deals, but what kind of understandings do these people have with these companies before they go to them? And, you know, what do these companies expect when they move from the agency to a private company like Booz Allen or SAIC or Northrop Grumman or any other of them? And I think, you know, that's something that really needs to be looked at too. Because we don't know. There's no transparency. There's no accountability. And there's just these very, very, you know, vague laws about, you know, you can't go from a top government position to a contractor and lobby. Well, a lot of what these people do, they're not lobbying. They might sit on a board of directors and they provide advice. They say, well, you know, these people that come out of the highest levels of intelligence, like Hayden, they know, you know, what the future plans of their agencies are, you know, 10 or 15 years. They know what the agency's doing, what it's looking for, and they go to these companies and they can provide real strategic advice on, you know, the kinds of programs they should pitch to the agency and that kind of thing. And so, they pitch things that are often wasteful. In the case of Trailblazer, that was, you know, Hayden basically handed over management and planning for that project to the private sector companies. You know, Booz Allen was one of the companies that advised them on the project at the initial stages. They decide among themselves that it should go to SAIC. SAIC gets in and runs it, hires these companies back as subcontractors, and then they completely fail to produce anything. And then, as you say, there's no accountability. The money keeps pouring in, despite the fact that it's a massive failure. They still get contracts. Hayden gets promoted, not only to the director of the CIA, he became a very senior official in the director of National Intelligence Office. And then, of course, now he's with the Chertoff Group, and he's also on the board of two companies that do business with NSA. So, you know, it's a spinning door, and it's a corrupt mess.
And of course, the Chertoff Group is really the poster boy for ripping off the government, where the former head of Homeland Security is able to sell these machines that scan you at airports, and a lot of them don't work, but he's made a ton of money.
And one thing about that is that, of course, when he's at the Homeland Security, when he was at the Department of Homeland Security, of course, he knew about, you know, these kinds of what the agencies needed, you know, what the agency in this case needed. And so he goes to the company and, you know, sells the equipment back to them. And this, you know, this kind of thing happens again and again. And if any of you bothers to look, if you bother to look at their website of the Chertoff Group, you'll see in the list of people that work for them, they've kind of created a little mini NSA there. It's, you know, Hayden is one. There's all kinds of people there that served at very high levels of the NSA that are working there.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Sharrock, who's a Washington-based investigative journalist and the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. He has an article at The Nation, A Modern-Day Stasi State. He also has an article at Salon.com, Meet the Contractors Analyzing Your Private Data. One of the questions I have, Tim, is that these private companies, even though in the case of Booz Allen they get 98% of their money from the U.S. taxpayer, they are still private entities. And what is to stop them from taking a contract, say, from the Koch brothers or for some corporation that wants to spy on a union that they don't like, they don't want to make a contract with, or the Koch brothers to spy on, say, environmental activists who are against the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, that's already happened. I mean, people were looking into this company Palantir and the relationships they had with a couple contractors that were digging up information for the Chamber of Commerce and other business organizations that were, you know, trying to hammer the environmental groups, you know, say they were against the oil, you know, pipeline coming in from Canada and that thing. So, you know, these companies can definitely be used that way. Doesn't necessarily mean that they use the same intelligence they gather for the agencies for that work, but it means that they know, you know, how to gather intelligence on people. And they have the technologies and the techniques to use the internet and to track people in all kinds of ways and hand that over in a package to the corporate clients that might be paying them to dig that information up.
Well, but they also have the government funded hardware to do it.
Exactly. I mean, they get the government funding and they win these contracts, and you know they make a lot of money on these projects. Mm-hmm. And of course, they use that money as well to lobby. And you know, one of the things I found is looking at some of these companies. You know, you look at their lobbying reports, and you know, it's not like they're passive, waiting around for RFPs to come from this agency or that, and then they bid for it, which is sort of the way it's sort of, you know, portrayed. But I mean, they go in Congress and they lobby, and you'll find in their lobbying reports they're lobbying to actually, you know, persuade Congress to privatize, you know, certain functions, and they're lobbying the agencies to privatize certain things. You'll see in their reports, you know, that's the issue they're lobbying on, privatization. And so, you know, they urge, you know, an agency or Congress to look at an agency and you know, make the, you know, contract out, you know, certain things, and then they bid for it when it becomes, you know, privatized. So they're using our money to build their markets and to outsource much more of our public services. You know, it's hard to use the word service when you look at surveillance, but, you know, this is the government. This is supposed to be a public service and supposed to be protecting us as citizens. Instead, it just seems to be, you know, making, you know, billions of dollars for private sector companies.
And, Tim Sharrock, in terms of your article at The Nation, A Modern-Day Stasi State, obviously, the Stasi were the East German secret police that were ubiquitous and controlled that state and controlled the rest of Germans at the front line of the Warsaw Pact during the Cold War to keep them on their side of the Berlin Wall. But what are the analogies then in terms of that kind of decrepit state being kept together by secret police at this, you know, ideological level? You know, closest thing, I think, to George Orwell's 1984. What is the comparison then to the United States here when, you know, so much of it just feels like government swindles from private contractors producing...
Right. Well, you know, first of all, that headline of that story is a little bit over the top. And I didn't write it, and that often happens in this business, because they lifted, you know, they took that from, you know, a paragraph I had. And what I was doing was, you know, Bill Binney, the whistleblower, has often said, you know, we're becoming like the Stasi. And what I was saying was, you know, with these revelations and the fact that, you know, Snowden was a contractor, and we know that there's, you know, half a million contractors with security clearances, and then there's maybe, you know, double or triple that, you know, 1 million or more government employees with security clearances. That's, you know, almost, you know, maybe 2 million people or more that have access to the secrets of their fellow citizens. And that's what I was comparing to the Stasi. I mean, the Stasi, it was like in East Germany, you know, like half the population was in the secret police and listening to the other half. And we're not quite there, but it's similar. I mean, we have millions of people that are monitoring us. And so where you have these sort of large complexes of intelligence industrial complex, they're not only in Washington, but they're in cities like, you know, San Antonio and now in Utah, where they're building this big NSA data center. You know, you have a lot of people, you know, working at these, you know, secret level, classified level at these intelligence agencies, and they're living amidst, you know, us, and they're spying on us. And I think that's what I was talking about. That's what it's beginning to resemble the Stasi in terms of, like, how many citizens have access to the secrets of others. There's this great movie made in about East Germany a few years ago that I believe won the Academy Award, but don't quote me on that, but it's called Lives of Others. People may remember that film. I really urge people to see that film because it shows, you know, how people that were involved in this began to see how wrong it was, because in the story they tell there, you know, they're told to wiretap, you know, an individual in the government, and it turns out that their boss who's urging them to do this is, you know, has some kind of beef with this guy, and he's basically trying to destroy him, and he's not a spy, he's not, you know, telling secrets to the United States or anything. He just is somebody that this manager there is at Stasi didn't like, and so they start bugging him, and they realize it's just basically a personal, you know, attack on this guy, and so they become, you know, begin to question, and perhaps, you know, Snowden went through, you know, some similar exercise where he thought, you know, what am I doing, you know, collecting all this information and my fellow citizens, and that's what he says, and you know, he seems very sincere in what he's saying about the doubts he had. I mean, I think he had no idea that his job would involve, you know, that kind of access to, you know, people's email and telephone calls and, you know, what they do on Facebook and et cetera. So I think he reached a similar realization. So, you know, I was attacked yesterday in the Wall Street Journal by somebody who said I was red baiting the NSA, which I think is hilarious. Anyway, that's how, you know, some people see this as, you know, very, you know, over the top kind of criticism. But, you know, sorry, we have a surveillance state that's unprecedented. And we have our technology is so far advanced than anything they ever even dreamed of in East Germany.
Well, again, Tim Sharrock, Washington-based investigative journalist and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. He has an article at The Nation, A Modern-Day Stasi State. So, but it seems to me that we have a whole extra level of surveillance that the East Germany, of course, which was largely, the surveillance state was largely to keep a failed ideology imposed on a people who were not getting any consumer goods. And for God's sake, you know, remember the Trabant, the terrible car with a two-stroke motor? But compare that extra layer we have here in the United States with the Googles and the Facebooks hoovering up all kinds of personal information about people who have willingly given away their rights. You know, if you have Gmail, you get it for free, but they get to literally read every email you have, your texts, your tweets. The whole thing is up for grabs. And yet I'm astounded that this commercial Stasi that we have doesn't seem to upset people.
It is strange, but maybe they'll think differently in 5 or 10 years. I don't know. It's maybe as more information comes out. But, you know, this is all supposed to be, you know, protecting us from terrorism. And that's what they say. And back in the Cold War, it was supposed to be protecting us from communist, you know, invasion. And there's always some kind of excuse for it. But to violate the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, to violate the First Amendment for that matter, I mean, I don't think a lot of Americans, when it comes down to it, really want to give up those kind of rights. I mean, you know, this warrant that the FISA court issued and that Snowden got hold of, it's the biggest leak ever in the FISA court's history, and that was just a general warrant. You know, they're not getting warrants for like one individual; they're getting warrants for the whole population. So it's just, you know, it's like they put out a huge net and just, you know, catch everybody, and then they download all that and they look at that for, you know, possible connections to, you know, whatever it is that they're looking for. And that's just a very dangerous situation. I mean, of course you want to catch people that, you know, you want to catch people like the Boston bombers before they did it before. But, you know, look at all we have in place when the Boston thing happened. And they certainly, you know, even they had tips from the Russians that these guys might have some connections that were questionable. And they looked at them and they apparently, you know, the system didn't work very well because they got away with what they did. So you have to wonder, like, how effective all of this really is.
Well, one of the when you talk about the Fourth Amendment, William Binney was telling me the other day that the Fifth Amendment has also been compromised by the surveillance state, because all of that information, for example, that Google and Facebook and that the government have, not that Google and Facebook use it against you in a court of law. They use it just to sell you stuff and to sell you. You may be having a boring conversation, but to them, they're making money. But the point that Binney was making is that there's so much information now out there that it can be used against you, which, of course, is the Fifth Amendment, that you're not supposed to be forced to incriminate yourself. Well, because it's out there, you're already incriminated.
He has a point there. I mean, I had never really quite thought of it that way, but I think that's very true. And that's, I mean, I plead guilty myself. I mean, I've been using Gmail for years, knowing that, you know, they can, you know, find out what I'm saying in my email, because they advertise. You know, I write a lot about Korea. I write a lot about North Korea and South Korea. So every time I send an email about Korea or I post a story or something, I get all these, you know, little advertisements on Gmail about, you know, Korea this or buy this Korean product or something like that. So, yes, it's true. And, you know, I think, I mean, I'm certainly, you know, against it, against this surveillance state, but I think we need to be a lot more careful about what we do put out online, because it's out there and it can easily be collected.
Well, just in closing, Tim Sharrock, the figure that up to 70% of the intelligence budget goes to private contractors, how did you come by that figure?
Oh, well, that was a unclassified document. It was an unclassified PowerPoint presentation that was given by an official with the Office of Director of National Intelligence to a acquisition conference sponsored by the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2007. And it was just sort of a general overview of acquisition practices and policies in intelligence. And the conference was designed to, you know, teach acquisition personnel sort of, you know, the basic rules of intelligence. And so this, you know, this person gave this presentation, and someone, you know, leaked it to me. And, you know, I'm paging through it, and there's this pie chart that showed, you know, this 70%. And, you know, I almost fell out of my chair, because I'd been looking for a figure like this for years. I had actually done an article, I think it was in Mother Jones in about 2005, sort of, you know, just a general article about this phenomenon. And I had talked to a bunch of people then, and they basically, you know, I came to the conclusion that maybe 50% of the budget went to contractors. And that seemed like, wow, that seemed like quite a bit to me, you know, half. But then it turned out to be 70. And then that percent was actually confirmed in 2008 by the ODNI itself in a press conference. The one and only press conference they've ever given on the size of the contractor workforce. And as I wrote about in my Salon piece, the official from DNI, who was, you know, head of their human capital division, who gave the press conference, went on to join Booz Allen Hamilton, and that's where he is now. So
right.
You know, spinning, it keeps on spinning.
Right. Well, Tim Sharrock, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Tim Sharrock, who's a Washington-based investigative journalist and the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. And he has an article at The Nation, A Modern-Day Stasi State. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the deficit hawks are still out there crowing in spite of the good news about the economy.
I'm looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the savage.
Not the end of the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Blyth, who's a professor of international political economy at Brown University. He's the author of Great Transformations, Economic Ideas and Institutional Change in the 20th Century. And his latest book is Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Blyth.
Nice to be here.
And what explains, Mark, the silence from the Sunday talk shows in the last few months? Over the last several years, there's been a drumbeat that the sky is falling because of the deficits. We had the near-death experience of U.S. debt with the Republicans and the Tea Party holding the full faith and credit of the United States hostage in order to get their way. That led to the sequester, etc. There's been an extraordinary amount of coverage about how the greatest problem facing the United States is the deficit. And yet, in the last couple of months, the Dow Jones index has topped 15,000 for the first time in history. The Congressional Budget Office has reduced deficit projections for 2013 by $200 billion. Standard & Poor's Consumer Confidence Index rose to its highest level since February of 2008. And Moody's upgraded the U.S. debt. So why is all this going unreported?
Well, you don't seriously expect people who have been banging the drumbeat on the Sunday talk shows and everywhere else to turn around and say, gee, I guess I was kind of wrong about everything. Oh, well, let's move on. So there's a simple kind of political cover story here, which is we didn't get our way previously, but we had the starve the beast strategy during the early part of the decade. That didn't work. Then we went for the let's create the giant debt panic story out of nothing. And that didn't work. And now the same forces will regroup and they will try and do it on something else. I suspect, once again, Social Security and its terrible looming crisis, which is another convenient fiction, will be the next target. But this is just politics as usual. And whenever they get called on it, they don't turn around in a minute.
So what's happening then with this Pete Peterson-funded group led by the so-called bipartisan group, the Simpson-Bowles Commission? My understanding is that the Fix the Debt companies that support them are now pushing for a new territorial tax system, which would save these companies up to $173 billion. So are we talking about sort of brains for hire by corporate America here, if indeed brains are the right term?
Well, I don't know the specifics of those proposals that you're referring to, but essentially the same forces will regroup and try and do the same thing a different way. Whether this is ultimately about tax avoidance or some other kind of strategy that they don't want to be on the hook for is, again, as I say, politics as usual. The more interesting part of this is, you know, at the end of the day, the United States prints the global reserve asset, has 15 aircraft carriers, has just struck oil at home and will become a net exporter. As you've pointed out, the confidence indicators are going the right way, all that sort of stuff. And the irony here, in many ways, if you compare it to Europe, is that the gridlock nature of the American fiscal system, in Congress in particular, has meant that the United States has one thing going for it. It hasn't been able to harm itself in the way that the Europeans have been able to do. So we have a real paradox here where this sort of, if you will, 18th century set of institutions has managed to stop the United States doing the kind of stupid damage to its own economy, which the putatively social democratic left in Europe seems too eager to embrace. That's quite an irony.
Well, specifically, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development has lowered its 2013 growth forecast for the Eurozone, expecting a 0.6% shrinkage compared to the United States GDP domestic product growing at 1.9%. So there's the contrast.
No, absolutely. And again, so much of this just comes down to the fact that there's a kind of myopia in the way that we think about government intervention when it comes to issues such as debts and deficits. So the sort of the standard right response is, well, you know, first of all, you shouldn't intervene because you have all these nonlinear feedbacks and other such complicated sounding things, unintended consequences. So we shouldn't do that. So, you know, we can't really spend. It's not going to be worth it. There's no multiplier effect for real, blah, 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 that sort of stuff. So that's the standard line. Yet exactly the other side, they say, but we need to cut. And they forget that cutting is every bit an intervention as much as spending is. So there's this wonderful asymmetry in the argument whereby spending is an intervention which is always bad, but cutting is not an intervention and it's always good. Well, unfortunately, the Eurozone's grand experiment in expansionary fiscal contraction has shown that up to be the utter nonsense it actually is. The tragedy is it's called 22 million extra unemployed to prove the point.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Blythe, a professor of international political economy at Brown University. He's the author of Great Transformations, Economic Ideas and Institutional Change in the 20th Century, and his latest book is Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. But it also seems, though, that the deficit hawks in this country, not only are they funded in large part by a Wall Street billionaire, Pete Peterson, and one of his sort of premier think tank whores, if I can use that expression, Maya McGuinness, is out there pounding the airwaves for him. But there is also amongst conservative Republicans, particularly the Christian conservatives, they have injected a moral dimension to this mythical problem of the deficits, where they talk about how we're stealing from our grandchildren. Why is it then that you can't have a counter-moral argument, which you just brought up tangentially, 22 million people out of work, not able to feed their families? Isn't that a moral issue compared to the abstraction of grandchildren being indebted, which is not, in fact, correct?
Yeah, well, you know, so much of this is, again, just politics by any and other means. So, you know, it's not as if the people making this argument genuinely care about other people's grandchildren. This is purely an instrumental logic. The counter-argument, of course, that could be made and has been made by many people is that, yeah, okay, so we'll cut now and we'll have a smaller economy going forward. So you'll have more people with higher rates of relative poverty. But don't worry, your grandchildren will have less debt, even if they'll be unemployed because the economy will be much smaller. So, I mean, both positions are abstractions, and both of them are being made to justify already constituted political positions. And again, there's no surprise in this. The only thing that really matters at the end of the day is, are you able to force this through? And again, the irony of history is that these 18th century gridlocked institutions actually stop the Republicans from doing this stuff. And the proof of the pudding is exactly as you said, the 3% deficit here, the 7% one in Britain, and the falling off the cliff ones in periphery Europe.
So why did the social democracies drink the Kool-Aid then? Because one of the great contrasts between the U.S. and the social democracies is that in the social democracies, you pay your taxes and the public money comes back to the public in the form of government services. Here in the United States, we have developed a form of right-wing welfare with the military-industrial complex, agribusiness, and the latest revelations about the intelligence-industrial complex, where billions and billions are literally being swindling the taxpayer for secret programs that don't work. So that seems to be a stark contrast. And yet the people who normally take care of their own people, at least the middle class, seem to be drinking the Kool-Aid. And I wonder why.
Well, you've got to think about 30 years of neoliberalism. The entire, I mean, if we talk about the spread of global neoliberalism, we tend to think about the United States' efforts to open capital accounts in the 1990s and the multilateral treaty on investment that failed in 1999. But in truth be told, the biggest neoliberal experiment of all time has been Europe since 1980. The Single European Act of 86, the Maastricht Treaty of 1992, creating the world's largest open capital space. If you join the EU, you pledge that you do not and will not ever put up capital controls, for example. So you have an extremely neoliberal economic settlement dominated by a giant central bank whose only concern is to fight an inflation that died in 1924, regardless of the economic consequences, with the consequence today that they're simply unable to deal with the problems they actually face, which are hyper-levered banks filled with toxic assets with a central bank that doesn't have the capacity to deal with it because it's got the wrong target and the wrong constitution behind it. So in a sense, you know, what these guys have done is build this grand neoliberal experiment, which is based upon a set of ideas that said the crisis of the type that we have can never actually happen. So when the crisis happened, they were constitutionally and intellectually ill-equipped to deal with it. So what did they do? They ran home to mama. They went back to first principles. Oh, there's too much debt. Well, then we need to cut it. These states have been spending too much. Blah, blah, blah. And of course, the truth is, which I try and go into the book in some detail, particularly in the third chapter, is that you can't really explain to your public that what's really happened is over the evolution of the euro, your banks have become three times the size and twice as levered as the Americans, and you can't bail them out. And they're too big to bail in the aggregate. And the Germans, the people with the money, are too small to liquidate the problem. So you basically squeeze, add liquidity, and pray and go through a grinding recession, hoping that the problem goes away. So for justificatory cover, you blame the Greeks and Italians for being lazy, even though it's got nothing to do with the problem.
So, in other words, you punish the victims of bad banking practices and leave the banks alone or make them whole?
That's exactly the same as on the United States. I mean, I don't remember too many congressmen jumping up and down in 2006 screaming about the out-of-control federal debts and deficits when the debt-to-GDP ratio was 61%. So how do you get up to 90, the magic Reinhardt and Brogoff threshold? Well, you do that by bailing out Wall Street. So what you basically do is you do asset and income insurance and reinsurance for the people who have had most of the assets and practically all of the income over the past 30 years. And then when the deficit blows up, people turn around and say, oh my goodness, look at all that debt. Where did that come from? This is out of control public spending. We need to cut this quick. Where's Social Security? Even though it's got absolutely nothing to do with what's going on or what caused it. I call it in the book the greatest bait and switch in human history, because that's exactly what it is. And the Europeans have exactly the same problem. They have these hyper-levered banks which can't relieve their toxic assets. They cannot recapitalize and delever. They've got lending start again. It's causing a crushing recession, massive unemployment, and they don't have the institutions, the constitution, or indeed the intellectual framework to understand it and deal with it.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Blyth, Professor of International Political Economy at Brown University and author of Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. That, of course, is the book that you referred to, which people should certainly get hold of to get more information about the argument you're putting forth, which is certainly refreshing to hear. So cynical interpretations like, for example, the economist Rob Johnson, I've interviewed him before during the protracted euro crisis, and he thought that perhaps the European elite were trying to borrow from the American oligarchical elite and get rid of the social programs and the social safety net that's much more deep and secure than what we have here. You're suggesting, no, it's just neoliberal ideology?
Well, the two of them are not exclusive phenomena. You can have people who use neoliberal ideology to get what they want, which is a smaller state. Yeah, you got to look at it this way. When you're taxing and spending 50 to 60% of GDP, you don't actually have to be a screaming right-winger to think that maybe some of that could be more effectively put to use by investment in the private sector. So it's not a question of defending any and all social programs. Some of the social programs that we have in the US and in Europe are colossally inefficient and don't serve the constituencies they're meant to serve. Medicare, for example, is a terrible program. It benefits doctors far more than it does patients. The entire business model we have for doing healthcare is ludicrous. So there's plenty of room for reforms on both sides. But to use, cynically, a crisis that was bailing out banks to put the put, if you will, on the people who can least afford to pay it, and use that as an instrument to get rid of welfare programs you don't like, that's a cynical and twisted politics. But it's not the only thing that's going on.
So why then, I don't take it that the Europeans are not buying this. There are lots of protests in Spain and in Greece, etc. So what explains why so many working Americans buy these deficit ideas and drink the Kool-Aid? I mean, look at the hostility towards Obamacare. That has a lot of political traction. I think for Europeans in a social democracy, it must be incomprehensible. And for Canadians right next door, you know, what's wrong with the Americans? Why don't they want proper health care? Even though, as you point out correctly, Medicare is a mess, this is a modest attempt to at least improve on that mess, isn't it?
Well, it is, but at the same time, I mean, if you want to do this properly, you would have to have a single-payer system, and that's not what Obamacare is. I mean, if I was a tangentially employed 24-year-old and I knew that a couple of years from now I'd have to find a couple of extra $100 to mandatorily insure myself, I might not think that's the best thing in the world at this point in my life cycle either. So, you know, I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm a full supporter. But, you know, again, to paint this in these incredibly broad brushstrokes is to fall victim to the type of broad brushstroke thinking we critique on the right so much. So I'd be hesitant to do so. I don't think it's a case of, you know, all or nothing for the welfare state in this way. As you say, there are huge welfare transfers to corporate America rather than the American public in this case. But by the same token, the Brits are taxing and spending nearly 50% of GDP, and they have a rotten welfare state. It's a terrible system, even including the National Health Service. So what exactly is the sweet point here? How do we get back to that?
Good question. What do you think?
Well, I think part of it is to lose some of the rhetoric on both sides. I mean, ultimately, the way I look at this and the way I put it in talks as well as in the book is the following. Democracy is asset insurance for the rich. Redistribution is reinsurance for democracy. So don't skimp on the payments. When you have a horribly skewed income distribution, as you do in the UK and the US, China and the US have basically the same Gini coefficient, a measure of inequality at the moment. you have a situation whereby the top, in very broad terms, don't consume enough because there's too few of them with too much cash. And the bottom, who are basically financially strapped and were kept on life support by a combination of importing Chinese deflation through Walmart and then on the other side having access to credit cards and other credit instruments, when those safety valves have gone now and it's exposed for what it is, we really have to do something about rising real wages and readdressing and redressing the income inequality in the country, because that's good for the economy when that happens. So at the end of the day, individual firms, their lobbyists can try and get out of taxes and do all this sort of stuff, but ultimately it's zero sum against itself. No one benefits if everybody tries to skimp. I mean, that's the critique that's leveled against Greece, for goodness sake. You think that we would learn from that, if nothing else?
Well, there was an interesting TED talk from a Silicon Valley billionaire who pointed out that he's incredibly rich, but he and his family can only eat out so often at expensive restaurants, and they can't buy 300 cars. They can only buy 3 or 4 at the most.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I was in Atlanta the other week, and I'm driving in from Atlanta, and the most advertised vehicle on the billboards as I went along the highway were Porsches. And I think to myself, how many Porsches can you possibly sell in Atlanta versus how many Volkswagens or whatever it would be? So if you can increase middle-class consumption, and you can do that through other than simply just the augmentation of credit, but you do that through real wage growth, then you get to a healthier economy, whereby you can have lower marginal tax rates because more people are paying it because they can afford to do so.
Well, the Center for American Progress, of course, have a new economic plan that's just come out, 300 million engines of growth. What's the chances? After all, it was the Obama administration that endorsed the Simpson-Bowles Commission. And do you think there's any chance that in 2014, rescuing the middle class will become the new political narrative?
Well, it will if the middle class are sensible enough to ask for it and insist that that's the case. But so long as large swathes of the middle class blame the government and buy the debt narrative and would actually see the debt cut before they would actually see the real wages increase, then people, in a sense, get the government they deserve.
Well, I thank you for joining us and for your a very cogent and realistic analysis of what's going on. I appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime, Ian. Lovely to talk to you. All the best.
All the best. Again, I've been speaking with Mark Blyth, who's a professor of international political economy at Brown University. He's the author of Great Transformations, Economic Ideas and Institutional Change in the 20th Century. And his latest book is Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the 50 worst charities that take in $1 billion and only give 50 million of that to the needy.
Yes to them, but to me, I'm a different kind. We're brothers of the same mind. I'm blind, caught in the middle end, not surrendering. I don't ride for the sake of Ritalin. Claiming I'm a smuggler. Some say I never heard of ya. A rap burglar. False media. We don't need it, do we?
It's fake as what it be. You dig me? Yo, Charmin, never fall in stand and show these people what time it is.
Here we go again.
I learned a good way. You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kendall Taggart, who's a researcher and reporter for California Watch and the Center for Investigative Reporting. She, along with Chris Hundley, recently partnered with CNN and the Tampa Bay Times and the Center for Investigative Reporting to conduct a year-long investigation to identify America's worst charities. Their report is available at cironline.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kendall Taggart.
Thanks for having me.
And what this study brings to the public is quite shocking, and that is it's a basically a year-long investigation identifying America's 50 worst charities. But I guess the statistic that the worst ones take in about $1 billion and pay out only $50 million to the needy. I mean, that's just an outrageous ratio.
Yeah, when we started looking at this, you know, we understood that every charity has fundraising costs, but wanted to identify a small and parasitic segment of the industry that has done far more for their for-profit telemarketing and other professional fundraisers than they have for the terminally ill children, firefighters, veterans, and the other causes that they claim to support.
Well, some of them, though, don't they have familial relationships with the fundraising companies? In other words, they subcontract to people that are either relatives or friends or cronies?
There is one organization that we highlighted called Kids Wish Network that operates out of a metal warehouse in Holiday, Florida. And the founder of that charity, they have paid him and his consulting firm $4.8 million over the past few years.
But the idea that you have to have these extraordinary overheads, what's the justification? The overhead is telemarketing to raise more money? Is that you pay money to raise money? Is that how it works?
You mean why is there so much overhead for these groups?
Yeah.
I think some of them say that they don't have any other way to raise money. It's one of the most expensive ways of doing it, though, and very few charities in the U.S. actually use telemarketers to raise their money. On the flip side, it's a win-win situation for some of them. I mean, they don't have to take on any risk, and they can pay themselves a decent salary without having to do much work at all.
So the egregious charity that you mentioned, the Kids Wish Foundation.
Kids Wish Network, yeah.
Sorry, Kids Wish Network. I imagine it's a foundation, right? A 501c3 tax-exempt?
It is, yeah. It's a tax-exempt organization.
Right. And they raise money in the name of dying children, right?
Mm-hmm. They do.
And that's about as low as you can go in terms of manipulating people's emotion. But it seems like they also are trying to jump on the bandwagon of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which is a genuine charity that doesn't involve telemarketing and actually spends its money on children with terminal illness. So is that what they're trying to do? They're trying to poach on that name?
Many of the charities we looked at do have names that certainly would make you think as a donor they had something to do with the better-known Make-A-Wish Foundation. When Kids Wish originally started, they were called Fulfill-A-Wish, and Make-A-Wish actually sued them over that to try and make it more clear to donors that they had nothing to do with their organization.
So what's the state of Florida doing about this? Who are the enforcement mechanisms or the watchdogs, apart from yourselves, over these charities who are, I think, without much doubt, not just ripping off the public, but they're also ripping off the victims, are they not, by promising to do something about dying children, and they do nothing for these children and do an awful lot for themselves.
Right. The responsibility for oversight of charities, while the IRS grants tax-exempt status, really does fall to state regulators, and it's an incredibly poor system where if you're shut down in one state, it's fairly easy to set up shop elsewhere and not have any consequences. When we were reporting, we found at least a dozen solicitation companies and charities that had been shut out of one state only to continue raising money elsewhere.
And why are so many of them in Florida?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly why. The regulators there have not taken many strong actions over the years. It's certainly one reason. There's also most of the people targeted by these telemarketers are elderly people.
Let me ask you about this one charity that promises to cure cancer. They paid a company owned by the president's son nearly $18 million over 8 years to solicit funds. That's an example of what we were talking about earlier, right? How the cost, the fundraising costs can actually be pocketed by the same people who are pocketing the big fees to do this, allegedly do the charity work in the first place. That's the first part of the money, right? The money is siphoned off for salaries, but then if they can find a way to make money out of the telemarketing side of it, which is designed to raise more money, mm-hmm. they can double dip, right?
Certainly. You make a good point. The money that we looked at is initially given by a donor, and then 80 or 90% of that straight off the bat goes to the outside professional telemarketer or other fundraiser. If your son or brother owns that company, then that's certainly a way to siphon money both out of the charity and into your own pocket.
Well, it may have been the Florida-based Project Cure, which has raised more than $65 million since 1998. But it ended up owing the fundraisers more than they raised. And according to their latest financial filing, the nonprofit is $3 million in debt.
Right.
So you raise $65 million and you end up being in debt.
Mm-hmm.
Something doesn't add up.
No, you're right. And when we've talked to experts, even from within the industry, they say that that should never happen. You should never be running a charity into debt like that.
So what is the overall takeaway from this? I mean, obviously, you don't want to discourage people from being charitable. But I see stuff on television, for example. There's a lot of advertising for our wounded warriors. And they use these sort of washed-up minor celebrities as front people. And I have no evidence whatsoever, except my own instincts, tell me that this is a scam. I mean, how does somebody like me, who is a reporter who by profession has to be a little cynical,
mm-hmm.
how do I proceed to figure out that this is a scam?
Well, I don't know specifically. I haven't looked at the numbers with Wounded Warriors, but a good resource for investigating charities is GuideStar has all of the tax filings for the most recent years available on their website. That's guidestar.org. One quick question that you should always ask if you're getting a call from a telemarketer is know that there's a high cost to that call. Find out exactly who's calling. Are they a volunteer? Are they a for-profit company? And ask them how much of what you give over the phone is actually going to make it to the charitable organization you think you're supporting.
But you were saying, Kendall Taggart, again, Kendall Taggart's a researcher and reporter for California Watch and the Center for Investigative Reporting. She, along with Chris Hundley, recently partnered with CNN, the Tampa Bay Times, and the Center for Investigative Reporting to conduct a year-long investigation to identify America's worst charities. Their report is available at cironline.org. You were just telling us earlier that one of the flags, the red flags, to make one suspicious of phony charities is the extent to which they employ telemarketers. And my understanding is that the legitimate charities like the Make-A-Wish Foundation don't employ telemarketers. Is that a good indicator of whether you're dealing with honest people who are actually going to, the money you give them is actually going to end up helping the needy?
To some degree, it can be a good indicator. There are certainly legitimate organizations that do use telemarketers, but I think that if you want to support an organization using telemarketers, many watchdogs will say that what you should do is hang up the phone and give directly if you want most of your donation to get to the organization itself.
Well, just to give our audience an idea of how egregious some of this is, from this Kids Wish Network, which seems to be, is that the worst of the 50?
It is, yep.
Because they, just in contrast to the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which has dozens of chapters across the country, last year it reported raising $3.1 million in cash and spent 60% of that, $1.8 million, granting wishes to dying children. The same year that this Kids Wish Network raised $18.6 million, its tax filing shows it spent just $240,000 granting wishes. That's 1% of the cash raised. That is truly outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm sorry, I'm sort of at a loss for words here. But tell me then, is this getting through to the public? I mean, it obviously got through to me because I just saw this online today and thought it was worth discussing. From your point of view, having worked on this study for a year, what's your initial understanding of the responses? And is there anybody like the Congress or the state legislatures? Is anybody going to stop this? It's bad enough that we have the need for charity, that in many ways the government doesn't provide the services that people need, and very decent and generous people are willing to help their fellow citizens in need. But the last thing we need are these parasites.
I'm not sure what the next steps will be. You know, we've certainly heard from some people who donated to these groups, and I think the impact there is immediate if people can be more aware of some of the organizations that are not doing what they claim to be doing with your donations. There are certainly proposals to try and help give state regulators more resources that would could help. The IRS, as you know, has its own mess going on right now, and I'm not sure what, if any, changes will happen at the federal level to improve the regulatory system.
Well, yeah, I guess they're somewhat preoccupied with the 501c4, which has been abused by in the political world, where billions have poured in to get candidates elected. The money, of course, is largely anonymous and not attributed. But this is the C3, not the C4 part.
Right.
Right.
Most of the ones we're looking at, there are a couple of C4s on the list.
Which they operate under the rubric of welfare, right? Isn't that social welfare?
Wait, all of them, you mean?
Well, the C4s apparently operate under the notion of social welfare. That's why it's so hard to understand, you know, what Karl Rove and Company are doing in terms of pouring billions into campaigns, and how could that be described as social welfare?
Right.
I imagine some of these phony charities can at least argue that they're in the social welfare business, even if they're just lining their own pockets.
Sure, yeah. No, most of them are, claiming to support much much better-known causes, improve public awareness about cancer or that kind of thing.
So just in closing then, Kendall Taggart, what's your advice to our listeners? How do they, for example, find out about the 50 worst? So that's the first place to start, is it? Not to give any money to these horrible parasites.
The place that you can find out about the 50 worst charities is at cironline.org/charities, plural. That will get you there. And then I think as a general note for donors, just always find out exactly where your donation is going and do research to make sure that it's being used the way you want it to.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Kendall Taggart, who's a researcher and reporter for California Watch and the Center for Investigative Reporting. She, along with Chris Hundley, recently partnered with CNN, the Tampa Bay Times, and the Center for Investigative Reporting to conduct a year-long investigation to identify America's worst charities. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time will last.